Welcome to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast that invites you to explore the curious world of dark genealogy, uncovering secrets, scandals, crimes, and other darker events that shape family trees. Whether you're a seasoned genealogist, just beginning to explore your family history, a history buff, or even a crime junkie, we offer something for everyone. Join us, your hosts, Danielle and Michelle, and each episode as we share stories from over a century ago for the first time with each other, centered around a common theme. By using newspaper archives as our guide and conducting research using historical records, we piece together these often forgotten stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. Our hope is to connect you, our listeners, with your ancestors' past one story at a time. All right, Michelle, here we are. We're at episode 10. I know, we made it. We are ending season two in a kind of comparative way to how we ended season one. But this one has a little bit of a twist. And although it involves murder, like our family story, this one more revolves around family curses.
Yep, similar to the last time.
Yeah, so basically this story, we uncovered it when we were doing our three-part episode at the end of last season on our family, their great-grandfather who was murdered by his mistress. And there was an article we had found that mentioned this particular person that we decided to research. And then from there, the snowball effect happened, right?
As a rabbit hole.
The rabbit hole. Yeah. So the story about our ancestor, Jeanette Putnam, it appeared this way in the newspaper. It says, "The tragedy recalls a somewhat similar one, which occurred in Burrville a score of a year ago. The wife of Ziba Petaplace, goaded to desperation by his drunken abuse, threatened to cut his head off if he came home drunk again. This he did not fail to do, and the wife was as good or as bad as her word, and horrible to relate, seized an axe and severed his head from his body."
Yikes.
Yep. And then it goes back to talking about our Jeanette Putnam. So at the time, like, I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. But when we really started digging in, this was this incident happened before our Jeanette story.
Almost 20 years, I think, right?
Yeah. So ours was in 78 and this incident took place in 60. Yeah. So it was kind of interesting to see the comparison along the way. But we're going to kind of just get in to Jeanette. I mean, to Jeanette. I was so used to talking about her. Oh, my goodness. To Lydia. So Lydia Harris, she was living in Burrville in 1860. On the census is Ziba, or also we saw
Ziba.
Ziba, yeah. So it was a few different misspellings. But Ziba was 44, Lydia was 47, Harris was 14, which was his son, and Ziba was listed as a farm laborer. They were living in Burrville, Rhode Island. We both kind of looked for records about her life prior and kind of had a little bit of a difficult time just given the time period.
Right.
And there were some things we found, but we weren't able to, like, verify completely. So I'm just going to list them, but just take them with a grain of salt. So we have that she was married once before we saw to a Stephen Tortoletto. Is that how you would pronounce that?
Yeah.
In 1835. 2 years later, on a summer day, he went into a neighbor's barn and hung himself with the cord of a whip. He was discovered before life had, he had died, would have tried to die, and they cut him down, and then he went directly to another barn and hung himself, which then he was successful.
Yeah, the article said with a chain that time. Yeah. So he escalated quickly to something different, just knew what he wanted to do, I guess.
And we wanted to kind of figure out, like, why, what was so bad that he wanted to do that, in the first place. We couldn't really find much of a marriage record or where she kind of was born, but there was an article that was written where it talks about a dad, James, and siblings George, Stephen, and Lewis, all of who had some type of freak accident or wrongdoing, I guess, for their killing, for how they were killed. One was listed as a railroad in Providence. One was listed as falling into a coal pit, which injured him and left him crippled. And then in 1845, supposedly one of the brothers, Lewis, went into the woods in Glendale and committed suicide by gun. So just the start of that, even though we weren't able to verify, just as crazy.
It's piled up very quickly.
Yeah. And it, who knows what time period this was. Was Lydia subjected to that? Did she?
Yeah.
How did she feel about? Who knows? So there's Lydia. So this census was literally 3 months before the event took place, which is just, here they are living their normal life, right? And she's being abused, and who knows if the son's being abused. Ziva's going on his way, getting drunk, and,
you know,
they're just doing their normal, right? So then September 22, 1860, she does, in fact, speak to her word. There was an article, the Detroit Free Press out of Michigan, that was written a few days after September 28, 1860. I'm just going to read it because it's quickly written, but it's murder by a wife. So Petaplace residence in Barville was murdered by his wife on Saturday afternoon last. He came home drunk and threw himself upon the floor. His wife took an axe and chopped off his head and then dragged him out into the orchard. Which, side note, similarity, because I feel like our family heard that about our murder, right? There was an orchard. And
it was always under the apple tree.
Yes, and she got dragged to the orchard, our lady. So.
Yeah.
So she then went back into the house and washed up the blood herself. The deed was witnessed by a son. This one says aged 12, who, you know, in our census, he's a little bit older. She had committed to jail to await her trial before the Supreme Court, and she excuses the deed on the ground that her husband was drunken, abused herself and family frequently, and threatened her life. So it's not looking good for her. The fact that, like, there was definitely different articles that all mentioned the same, but they were kind of written all over. So you had Michigan, you had Massachusetts, obviously Burrville.
I feel like it's like telephone. Like, it is. Once they get further away from the area where it happened, I feel like they're details are a little
extravagant.
Yeah, they like to elaborate on things that I don't know if necessarily they're true. So it's hard to, like, they pick an article from New England and then they'll write it in like Michigan said. So is it accurate or is it just kind of just like intriguing?
And who's gonna check on them? Right? Because they're one actually a few articles actually came from Canada. So
all over.
So a couple of the articles just mentioned little things. A few occasions, the family was mentioned to be, as quoted here, the family was not to the highest character, it was written.
Yeah.
There was a deficit in intelligence.
Yep.
Was another way it was written.
I've read that several times, that they didn't speak very highly of the family's intellect or, you know, comprehending what was actually going on.
Yeah. So that happened. There was a deputy sheriff, Steer, who was the first, I guess, to come to arrest her. And it was quoted that she appeared quiet and concerned. She acknowledged the deed and, you know, kind of probably similar to Jeanette in our story, that she kind probably just had enough of it. Like,
Just accepting your fate at that point.
Yeah, like, what, going to jail or living in this life that she was living? I mean,
yeah.
You know, there might not be much of a huge difference, but so there was that. And it said it took 2 hours, the article, after the deed happened, for someone to actually come to the house and, you know, things to progress from there. And it said that the son had carried the news about 2 miles to where his sister was living, which was at the residence of James J. Colby. So after that, we kind of find some articles regarding the her guilty plea. So the Providence Evening Press wrote on October 4th, 1860. It was very short. It said the following were arranged and pleaded guilty. And that was Lydia Petaplace of Burville for the murder of her husband with an axe. So they always tied the story with the axe. Like, that was the thing.
She was the axe murderer.
Yes. That had to go hand in hand with whatever they were talking about.
I mean, it's a catchy headline, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, just spark interest.
I read on.
Exactly. And then A little while after that was the actual Supreme Court sentencing. It was the Providence Evening Press, April 16, 1861, which wrote that the indictment State versus Lydia Petteplace of Burrville verdict guilty, sentenced to imprisonment for life. So that's a big deal. I mean, she's in her mid, what did I say? She was 47. So that's quite a long time that you might have to live in prison. That's a lot to swallow.
Yep.
Then there was an article that just kind of mentioned, you know, she lived her time in jail and it became like her home, obviously, because that's all she had at that point. And that everyone kind of became familiar with her in the jail, that people would sort of always curious about her and would come and just be interested in her life and what she was doing. And she had spent a lot of time at the prison in Cranston. And then that was later, they later moved to a different prison. And that's when sort of her insanity started to become noticeable.
Yeah, I think it was actually the insane asylum that they moved her to, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right. So, and I believe it was about 8 years that she kind of lived on with that sort of insane, probably just who knows, life. But they said most of the time she was just quiet, kind. And then towards the end, this article mentions that she got a little mad.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, I always find it fascinating to find like them in the censuses in the prison. So I saw like her in 1870, it was the county jail Providence. She was 60 years old and it was checked off that she was not insane at that time. And then 1875, it's Lydia inmate Providence. She was 65. It listed her as a housekeeper. So I think I read somewhere else that they kind of were able to move a little bit more freely. And so she probably took a job that allowed her to kind of do that. And then also there was an 1885 census where she was 75, listed as inmate at the Cranston Insane Asylum. So, yeah, that's hopefully, you know, her life was good. I read this article that popped up in the Providence Evening Press in September 20, 1868 that kind of was writing about the state prison and how it worked, how people live there. So, you know, this would have been 6 years after she had been there.
Yeah.
So really kind of gave a glimpse. It said that before they even walked in, that above the heavy iron doors, there was something that read, "The way of the transgressors is hard." Yeah. And yeah. And then at the time, the prison held 54 prisoners. There was all ages, more men than women. And then she was kind of highlighted in the article as being one of 10 that were life prisoners. The oldest being Miss Studley, who was incarcerated for murder in 1858, and she was 77 years old. She said she was worn and a decaying woman. So, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, 1858, she's 77. She didn't have to live too long. But then followed was Lydia, who was 58 at the time, sentenced in 1861. It says for the brutal murder of her husband with a axe. And said that the head completely severed from the body, which is, you know, just a gory detail there. But and then I also listed James Webster, who was 32, a carpenter by trade, who was listed as healthy and vigorous and merry. It was kind of cut off the article, but it seemed like it might have been an incident of a bar and drinking and just getting a little bit too violent. But 32, that's a long time to live out your sentence. And then there was one more person they mentioned, a sailor, Robert Crow, committed committed in 1867 for the murder on the high seas.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of was like, oh, I need to kind of look back into that.
That one sounds interesting.
Yeah, that one sounds interesting. So the article mentioned the women would make brooms and the males would make shoes. They wore gray suits. It said the food was actually pretty good. They had a sort of a balanced meal compared to maybe some others who were just living in the normal world who were maybe not so, you know,
wasn't provided to them.
And they said the cells were small but clean. So despite where she was, I mean,
it was her punishment for her crime.
So she just had to do it. So So then we get to sort of, she's, you know, spends her life, the rest of her life in prison, and she dies September 27, 1886 at the age of 71, 72. So there was an article I found, the Barville Gazette, which was published in Pascogue. It was written on October 1st, 1886. And it just kind of talks about her story and her family. And we'll go on to her family because this is when it starts unraveling a lot more. So she was actually buried at the State Farm Cemetery in Cranston. Just kind of sad to find out that that cemetery was in use from 1875 through 1918, and now it lies under the roadbed on Route 37, and there are no stone markers remaining. And
yeah, they built it right over the top of the gravesites.
Sick.
Yeah, that's messy.
Yeah, I don't like that. So,
like, they didn't even attempt to move. Did they not know they were there? Was there no, like, oh, we don't care because there were inmates? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably the second thing.
Yeah. I don't know. The state is messy with roads. It's messy. Yeah,
I agree.
Messy.
But yeah, so that's a little bit about Lydia. But Michelle's going to speak next to sort of where we go with sort of this generational trauma, should we call it? You know, so I'll pass it to her, starting with Harris, who just... remember, was at the home the time this incident happened as a teenager. So just that alone is some heavy stuff.
Right. Okay. So Harris Fetterplace was Ziva and Lydia's son. He was born in 1847. Interesting fact we kind of just put together a second was that it looks like, you know, after his parents were no longer around, available to raise him at such a young age, it looks like he went to live with his sister, Mary Ellen Fetterplace, and then Israel Young Jr. And then he did marry when he was 19 years old. He married 29-year-old Betsy Jane Young, which is a sibling of his brother-in-law. So siblings, basically
marrying
siblings, but they're not like
not ancestral.
not blood relations, at least. So that's good, but the 10-year age difference really kind of threw me in a loop. But they did have a son. His name was Henry, and we did a little digging, and Henry actually got married later in life, and he had several stepchildren in North Smithfield. So Henry seemed to have a better life than the generations before him. So Harris ended up, there's an article that we uncovered about poor Harris. He fell into very similar fate as his other relatives. So this was from the Boston Globe, Thursday, August 26th, 1886. Found in the woods. After days of wary search by his neighbors, the body of farmer Fetterplace with his head blown off. So it says in Woonsocket, but they weren't. It's Barville. So August 22nd, at noon Sunday last, Harris Fetterplace left his home near Herring Pond. So that's where all of this took place. We now call it Spring Lake. Mm-hmm. But the whole Fetterplace family, like even the graveyard is still in that area.
They have lots just for the Fetterplace family.
Yeah, Harris Fetterplace, right? So near Herring Pond in Barville, ostensibly for the purpose of hunting, he took his gun with him and told his wife that he would soon return. It seemed strange, however, that he took a particular care to tie up his dog before going. It was also apparent upon close observing his wife, he carried little ammunition with him. It was also known to her that the gun was loaded. He was in his shirt sleeves and through trying to appear easy in manner and only doing what he was accustomed often to do. There was a look of countenance which did not seem all right. Yet, as he was a man of steady habits and of kindly disposition, no serious thought entered into the mind of Mrs. Fetterplace as to the intentions of her husband. He was in good health and had little of the world's cares to bother him, so that his spirits would be light. He went forth, but did not return. After hours of absence, his wife becomes uneasy and informed the neighbors that she feared something might be wrong. A search was then instituted, but no tidings of the missing man could be found. The search was kept up through Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and hundreds of people took part. The neighboring woods and swamps were all scoured, and the shores of Herring Pond explored, but still no trace could be discovered of what had become of him. This morning, the search was again renewed, and in the woods about half a mile northeast of his residence, his lifeless body was found lying prostrate on the earth, with the top of his head blown off, with his gun lying beside him. The conclusion was at once arrived to that he had committed suicide. An inquest will be held this afternoon, at which some further facts in relation to the death may be obtained. He was only 40 years old.
Yeah, that's...
So, he just seemed fine, she said.
Yeah. And
I don't know.
But that's what, I mean... Some
you
people can
see
really
that
just...
you see your parent murder your other parent. I
yeah,
feel like
some trauma.
Yeah, that's definitely not okay. So he didn't like his wife. See, he said he was a kind person. So maybe he just hit it too well, and he didn't talk yeah. about what was happening in his head. You know,
because yeah, I think I saw an article too that was just saying like he was a good worker. Yeah. Like all around, he was just living his life.
It was just really hard to read that. It was like, you know, he didn't seem like he was. An alcoholic like no. his father or didn't beat his wife, so I don't know, it's hard to hear when people just don't talk about their yeah. issues and then do something drastic like that.
Oh, I agree. So then we keep digging, right?
Yeah.
And this is when it starts to like, is the family cursed or is there some kind of like generational mental health
yeah
aspect to it where, you know,
they live with depression and they
yeah,
don't
the whole
they don't
family.
Talk about
yeah.
what's going on and
yeah
it just haunts them.
So we say that because we have Harris, who's just committed suicide,
right?
And now we have Israel Young, who is Mary and Israel's child. So yeah. This would have been Harris's
nephew.
Yeah. We have him committing suicide in 1897. So not only does poor Mary have her mother, you know, who's spent her life in prison and died there and killed
right.
her dad.
Right.
And her brother who committed suicide. Now her own child, who, you know, wasn't an older into their life, but still...
She had to live through
she
that.
She had to live through that again.
Yeah.
Which is just horrible for a parent. I can't even imagine. So there's a quick little article. It says that Israel Young, the town surveyor of Barrville, shot himself dead early this morning. His body was found on the road with a bullet hole in the head. He had shot himself while in his buggy and had rolled out. His horse walked into the village of Harrisville, drawing the blood-bespattered buggy. Young was 34 years old and was a prosperous farmer. He was apparently contented, but his life was like that of many and other members of his family.
Yeah.
So then it goes into talking about Lydia and the uncle. So it's just, yeah, it's just like what's happening to this poor family. It's
like 100 years of
yeah,
just
trauma.
Like nonstop. Like
yeah.
Every generation had some kind of murder or death or suicide. It's
right.
just
like how does one family
yeah.
deal with all that?
Yeah.
That's a lot. And so there was another article that said that, you know, he had gone and gotten taken money out the day prior and had paid someone for something. And so maybe he was planning it. I think that's kind of the point where.
Yeah. He was putting his affairs in order, it seemed
yeah.
like, yeah.
Yep, so when we keep on, you know, there was one article specifically, it was quite lengthy, but it had mentioned, again, all of the family members that had, you know, some type of tragedy. And there was specifically listed an Ezekiel Young, which was listed as an uncle. So this could have been a great uncle or an uncle of his father's side. So his father was also Israel, so it could have been, you know, tied to there. But what I could find on him specifically was that he also committed suicide. There was a quick article that said It transpires that Ezekiel Young, station agent at Pasco, who committed suicide the other day, was driven to it by drink and debt, and his discouraged from the company. He invited his creditors, several tradespeople, to all be at the depot on Monday morning at 8 o'clock and get their pay, and they called and found Young stiff and cold with a bullet through his brain.
Gosh.
Yeah. So the fact, again, that he kind of had a call out to people to come get their money and then be there. I also found, so that happened in 1985. I also found another record that he had a child, Alice Young. It says the six-year-old daughter of the late Ezekiel Young has found a home through the efforts of O.A. Inman with William Mansfield of Providence, a gentleman who for many years has been an employee of the Providence Furniture Co. He will adopt the child if all parties are satisfied after a short trial. And then I find censuses of him living, you know, he's got multiple children. I think the latest one I saw was, 1880. He's living Ezekiel Young, 43. He's married to Esther Young, 36. Ruby Young, 16, Alice, 10, and Evelyn, 1. So they're living in Burrville, and then, you know, that event takes him, and the children seem to get displaced. I'm wondering if the wife had died in childbirth for maybe the youngest or something, because I didn't get to dig around too much into her. And then I kind of was trying to go down the rabbit trail of the kids, and I found an Alice Young in 1907 living as an inmate in Cranston. So I was like, wait, what? So I don't know if this is the right person. I don't know if Alice was adopted by that Mansfield. Did she take that name? So could be the wrong Alice, but I was like, okay, I'm just going to stop here. But what I did find on the Find a Grave was a picture of Ezekiel's headstone, and it said, "Farewell, dear children, my life is past. I love you while my life did last. Weep not for me, no sorrow take. We'll meet sometime at heaven's gate." Sad.
It's very sad.
So it doesn't stop there, though, does it, Michelle?
No.
Because the more we kind of just dig around, we might have had a harder time finding connection, but there's a ton of Pet a Place or, you know, names out there that have followed similar tracks, I guess. I don't think you found another one just recently.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was, you know, doing our newspaper searches and just typing in Pet a Place, murder, all the keywords where and like the area. And then this story pops up very end of the year. So this one was actually in Canada. This story was published in the Telegraph Journal, St. John, New Brunswick, Canada, Friday, December 31st, 1880. Nothing like bringing in the new year with another Better Place tragedy, okay? So this one says, the latest tragedy in Providence. This one, December 28th, the particulars of an attempt at murder, which might have proved fatal in two persons, to the probable fatal terminations of attempt on the part of a would-be murderer to commit suicide. Just now, the inhabitants of the quiet town of Gloucester, 15 miles from Providence, the facts would have been brought to light are briefly as follows. Within the town limits is a notorious resort frequented by young men of Gloucester in the manufacturing village of Chepachet, which we all know, drive through there frequently. It is alleged that among the inhabitants was a married man named Pet a Place, who kept company with one of the inmates named Harrington. So, inmates, I'm thinking this is like a brothel of sorts. Like, the way this is written, it's like a young men frequented. So, I'm like, what kind of establishment is this in Chepachet? That's interesting. Maybe we didn't need to go to the Wild West.
I know. We went to Wild West last week. The red lights.
Okay. So last Wednesday, this woman, during the absence of Pet a Place, went to on a ride with a certain young man, which is housed, to demand an explanation from who made Pet a Place so jealous that he went to the house to demand an explanation from the woman. The latter told him that she did not care for him, Pet a Place, and that he went away. The inmates of the house supposed The fair was at an end. The Harrington woman retired that night shortly after 10 o'clock, occupying a couch of another female on the ground floor. So they had been in bed a little time when a window of the room was cautiously opened, a hand inserted beneath the curtain, and immediately four pistol shots fired in rapid succession. The perpetrator, on the going to the room, found that one of the bullets had struck an above-mentioned companion in the left breast, severing her left nipple.
Oh, very descriptive.
The bullet also struck the Harrington woman in the left arm, just below the elbow, and lodged in the hand, I guess. Three of the bullets lodged in the wall over the latter's head. The would-be murderer could not be found that night. Then the next morning, when the boy who builds fires in the trap schoolhouse entered the building, found young Petablaze bathed in his own blood, lying in one corner of the room. He was living, and the hand... and handed a revolver to the boy, telling him that he would have no further use for it, and requested the lad take it to a person from whom he had borrowed it. It seems that, that's kind of comical. It seems really sad and disturbing. I don't know. Just hearing, he hands it to the boy, bring this back to my buddy. I don't need it anymore.
It's the way they wrote it. Yeah, you just have, this imagination going of what it was like.
Were they writing it to be funny? Because it seems kind of... Just, I don't know. Just seems doesn't seem real. But it is real. So here we go. So he handed it to the boy. So it seems that after Petablaze had left the place of the attempted murder, went near Trapp's Bridge, he took out a revolver and shot himself, the bullet entering about 1 inch above his heart. Weakened by blood loss, he crawled to the schoolhouse, which he entered by the cellar window. With his condition become known, he had... removed to his father's house, and Dr. Potter was called, probed for the bullet, but failed to find it. It is reported that there's no hope of his recovery, and there's no reason for arrest to be made. Okay, so you think he's done. Well, yeah. Actually, he lives on.
Does he?
Yeah, he.
Wait, because did they mention the name of the person? I know they say Petablaze, but.
Oh, his. Yeah, that's how I found it. I kept searching, and it comes up that there's a indictment for him, and his name is Erastus.
Ooh,
pretty interesting, right?
Almost like arrested.
Yeah. So this is from the Providence Evening Press, so March 23rd, 1881, so a few months after. Yeah. So indictment state versus Erastus Petablaze. Defendant is accused of having assaulted one Betsy Ida Harrington in Gloucester.
Another Betsy, huh?
Yeah, so many Betsys, and it's with the S-E-Y at the end, so I'm like, okay. And then that's not the last Betsy we're going to read about either. So the pistol loaded with intent to murder her. On the 22nd of December, it is claimed that the defendant came to Mrs. Harrington's house, asked for a bundle belonging to him, which is not what the other story says. But this is what this indictment says, which he was given. And after obtaining a match, he left at 11 o'clock. At night, Mrs. Harrington retired to the chamber occupied by herself, her sister, and her baby.
Oh, Jesus.
Right? There's a baby there now. Oh, man.
Yeah.
After she was in bed, the defendant came in her window, fired three shots and a pistol. Mrs. Harrington jumped from the bed and exclaims, "You stop that rapist." It's literally in quotes, okay? And attempted to escape from the room, whereupon the defendant exclaimed, "You'll never live to go with Sid Durfee again." And he fired another shot. So I guess Sid Durfee was...
The other man
involved in this situation. So after another shot was fired, which lodged in her arm, the defendant ran off and shot himself so seriously that his arrest was deferred for some time. The defendant admits that he fired and shot the wounded Mrs. Harrington, but denies that he had any other intent than that of frightening Gideon Durfee, whom he was supposed was in the room with her. He became enamored of her some time before and waited upon her with the audacity and devotion until the day of the offense. Sounds like a stalker psychopath to me.
Yeah, I mean, crawling through the window, yeah.
So, when he started this discovery, in the devotion until the day of the offense, when he was startled by discovering her at Chepachet, accompanied by Durfee, who has carried her home in his carriage, he was enraged and had no intention of hurting her. After the firing, the defendant carelessly put the pistol in his pocket, where it was accidentally discharged. Okay. In your chest pocket? Because didn't they say it wasn't above his heart? Like, I'm like, this is not tracking at all. This is what I mean. These articles.
Yeah, they get
one
little...
says one thing. One's like...
This one was Canada too, though, right?
You yeah, said... that other one was Canada. Yeah, this okay. one says Providence. So okay. maybe Providence is a little more accurate. And it's an indictment. So
yeah,
they might actually have some files. Yeah. Facts here. So after firing, the defendant carelessly put it in his pocket where he accidentally just started wounding himself in the breast after he would drag himself to a schoolhouse where he remained until morning. Still pending. So that was in March. But apparently he doesn't end up going to jail. There's like, there's him, an article that he actually found marriage records. So he actually married in, I believe it was 1890. Yep. 1890. He married in July. He married a Betsy, who it was his second marriage. So he had married earlier in life too.
Okay. Yeah.
And then it said he was married in the article too, remember?
Yeah.
So he was married at the time. But then he marries this Betsy, who it is her, it's Betsy A. King. She married a weaver at some point. But this was her fourth marriage.
Oh,
so I don't know if this is the same Betsy, but this was Betsy. The other one was Betsy Ida Harrington. So we've got so many
Betsys happening.
Betsys in this
family.
Must have
been a very popular name of the time.
Yeah. So Erasmus, and that's not the end of the articles about him. That's not even the end of it. Because I was like, oh, he must have, you know, he must have been sick or died. But yeah. That was already months later. He was still alive. Because that first article made it sound like he's a goner.
Like, yeah, like
the doctor couldn't find the bullet. He's just like, we're just going to let him get his own. But he lived on. Okay. And then I keep looking, keep searching. And then the Boston Globe came through.
Okay.
And this is Saturday, September 10th. We're already into 1892. So he's been married a couple years now. So it says, man and wife slashed.
There it is. So, oh, man.
So, you know, the violence and the knives, it just knives, axes, here we go. So, charged that James Cooney Saturday on guard all night, a butcher knife in hand at bedside of sick man near Chepachet, Rhode Island. So, the town officers of Foster and Gloucester are in pursuit of James Cooney, who, it is charged, made an attempt at the double murder upon Erastus Better Place and his wife Betsy. who reside in Chepachet. So Cooney is a drinking man and had been in the habit of going about in different neighboring houses and raising a disturbance. Not a half a mile from his house and a quarter mile away from the roadside, well surrounded by the thicket of woods, stands the homestead of the Fetterplus family. It just reminded me of the articles where it was talking about the Eyed House.
Yeah.
Didn't it? Like,
I know. And they mentioned Foster too, which is they're looking at Foster for this guy because they're so close.
Yep. And then Erastus Fetterplus was sick and sick abed when Cooney called. He seized a butcher knife and it is charged, walked about in different rooms of the Fetterplus house and began to threaten the two helpless inmates, Mrs. and Mrs. Fetterplus. Till further charged that when Mrs. Fetterplus made an attempt to console Cooney and entreated him to leave the house, he turned on the sick husband and gashed him in the neck.
Oh, man.
And then he went for Mrs. Fetterplus and carved at her with her head a couple times. The blood flowing freely covered all parts of her clothing.
Oh, gosh.
The two helpless people shouted outdoors for aid, but the closest neighbors beyond the Cooney home was 3/4 of a mile away, and no one heard the outcry.
Helpless.
Yep. After the double assault, the story goes, Cooney wandered about the house and made more threats, and then settled down into a chair and stood guard all night long over the sick husband. In his hand, he had the knife. After much persuasion, he allowed Mrs. Fetterplus to dress the wounds on her husband and herself. It was dawn when Cooney started for home, and then Fetterplus sent for the doctor at Chepachet, and the wounds were sewed up and dressed. It is some hours after that Mrs. Fetterplus reported the affair to the town constable, and then a chase was made by the deputy sheriff Ham of this county into the wilderness where Cooney had gone, deserting his home for a time. After the line into Connecticut, the officers followed the trail, but without avail. There's little doubt saying that Fetterplus, that Cooney could have killed them both had he had a little more liquor in him. he will be captured within the next few days. So
it's weird though that he just kind of like injured them and then just wanted to like sit there until morning.
Yeah, psycho, drunk. Yeah. Like these people in this area seemed like they had some kind of
drinking. To your point though, like, or to the point of the article, like, he could have killed them.
Yeah.
So what was the whole purpose?
Like, why did he even go into their house?
Yeah.
Like, was he just bored on his way home and was like, I'm angry. I'm going to just, like, there was no motive in that at all. Yeah, I kept reading, trying to find, like.
So they never found him.
Well, not that I know. I lost track of that after. Just like, that was my last, that was the last article about Erastus. He lived on. He outlived his wife. I lost track of him. He was in a census with his nephew, Franklin.
Okay.
In 1920 was the last I could find of him. So he lived past
1920. Now, I know that we don't have, like, specific records, but to your knowledge, this is probably a connection through.
Yeah, his father was Otis, and then we looked at Seth was Ziba's father.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep looking, but I'm trying to find a common ancestor between Seth and Otis.
Whether it's brothers or
like uncles and or there's cousins. Like, there was in a family tree I found where there's someone who came over from England. I think he was like one of the original Fetoplists in Rhode Island because he came into Newport. So I think, and that was in like the 1600s. So I think they're like one of the original founding families of Rhode Island, it seems.
But yet they weren't considered.
No, not until, I mean, maybe it kind of
trickled down.
Yeah, as it went through. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm sure there's so, like, we could have probably kept digging and digging and digging.
This name, like, I don't hear that name often now.
No, I don't know anybody with that.
Like, I don't even know how to pronounce it correctly. Fetoplays.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. Yeah. Yeah, I don't really know. So the way that, when I first heard it, I was like, okay, yeah, this family's cursed or something going on. Yeah. But yeah, I'm more thinking now, like, that just like mental health.
Yeah.
Some kind generational.
Of genetic predisposition to depression and, you know, maybe even like schizophrenia, bipolar kind of
something,
stuff.
Something, yeah, something that was not, like.
Well, we know Lydia, they were like.
Oh, yeah.
Lydia's definitely off. They, like,
got something.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting to know, like, if I look back at the dates, you got like September and like when everything happened, like, was it during the winter months where things are colder, seasonal, darker?
Yeah. Well, I think Harris, it was in the summer. It was August.
Yeah.
So
I think Israel's like November.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you just think, again, back to like our family story with Jeanette, she got away.
Yeah.
What makes us so different? Maybe time has gone by. We were kind of saying a little earlier before we were getting started that maybe it's just Jeanette had more people on her side. She had reliable neighbors that
Stephen
stood up
Tucker,
for her.
I feel like, you know, it wasn't something new that happened. Like, he had seen how terrible William Ide was to her and the rest of the family, and even like other neighbors. Remember,
townspeople were afraid of him.
Yeah.
And then Jeanette was a lot younger and she had young children.
Yeah.
Maybe more people took more pity on her for whichever reason.
And she did have like financial backing. Remember, there was like
people donated money.
It was like $5,000 for her legal fees. So maybe she had better like legal counsel and they could get her out of it. And they also commented on her looks. Not to say like, that could play a part in it.
Yeah, no, it could. And I think that this poor family, could they have had someone with more money or someone more reputable, I guess, in their family? Yeah. Would it have been different?
Yeah.
I mean, life in prison.
And maybe the method of the murder too. Like, Jeanette, it seemed more in like self-defense. Where this other guy, like, Lydia seemed like he was lying on the floor, like, was he passed out drunk? Right. And she just chopped his head off.
No, I know.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
because, that's a good point, because Jeanette literally had been
dragged
to the orchard, barely could, probably think she was going to live.
Right.
Where, Lydia was getting abused, which should not still happen.
Right.
But it wasn't as visible, maybe.
Right, maybe.
I don't know.
We were just trying to make sense of why Lydia got a life sentence and then Jeanette got off and she got to live like a normal life, remarrying and
yeah,
kind of like getting redemption almost.
Yeah, it makes you just wonder like the way the justice system worked back then. And
or maybe she was more stable mentally, you know,
and like, that's true,
like knew like who she needed to talk to and what she needed to get done, whereas Lydia just she
spent 2 hours mentally cleaning the floor before.
That's true.
I don't know. I don't really know. So, I mean, this definitely was an interesting story. I reached out to some people in Ancestry who were also trying to crack this, you know, family story, not without any additional information. So, if anyone out there is listening, I mean, so we got the Young family, we've got the Pettaplace, and we got Harris, all connected. So, if you know anything or have any insight, that'd be really helpful. And I think that... for me, which was kind of cool because this is a little closer to home, I found a lot of great resources again with the public library has now all of the Burrville archive, newspaper archives, where you can use online for free. And I found a lot using Google Archives, which is free. So, you know, if you're listening and you want to start some family research, you don't have to pay to get started.
Or even the state, like our state has great vital records, and you can even look at the indexes to find the names. And then you can look in, they have digitalized copies of the actual books where they would write like the cause of death. So we've seen the cause of death. It says murdered by wife for Ziba.
Yeah.
And then
suicide
for
Harris.
Yeah. So it shows like literally in cursive handwriting. We should get wasn't like the National Archives looking for somebody who can read
cursive
writing because nobody knows how to read cursive anymore.
I know, it's so sad.
I'm getting better at it.
It is a little scribbly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you don't have to be able to, you know, pay for a site or do this. And it's obviously helpful. There's definitely additional things you can get from there. But if you're just starting your family history, it's really valuable resources out there that you can tap into.
Yep.
So, but that concludes us. I would say we've done very well this season. We've hit on some new topics. We hit on some of our favorites that were kind of fun to dive into. You know, fall, we'll be back at it. So if you have any like topics or family, you know, interesting family information that you want to send our way, we can definitely look into that for you. And we're going to plan on trying to tap into social media a bit more and try to.
Yeah, because we are on Facebook and we're on YouTube now. We have all of our episodes on YouTube. You can listen to there as well as the regular podcast sites like Apple and Google. So
Perfect. Well, Michelle, this episode was fun because we get to kind of work together.
Yeah, we don't usually work together on the same story, but so it was good.
Fun. But stay tuned. And remember, it's not a matter of if you will find a shadow in your family tree, but when, because behind every family tree, there are shadows.
Thanks for listening.